Everyone, and welcome to another episode of Double Shelix. I'm Kayla.
And I'm Sally. And today we are extremely excited to welcome Dr. Chrissy Stachel. She is going to be speaking with us about her role as founder and CEO of Reflecting Equity and her living the life of having turned her PhD thesis research into a consultancy business that helps organizations foster strong and equitable communities. Chrissy, thank you for being here and welcome to Double Shelix.
Hi, I'm so excited to be here. Thank you for having me.
We are super excited to have you. I'm really interested to hear about all of your work. But first, maybe you can tell us a little bit about your background and your PhD and what you were working on. And then we can get into what you're doing now.
How do I start? I grew up in Miami, so I am Latina. My family is in Colombia. And I really didn't know the direction that I wanted my kind of career or anything to go in until I had my first research experience in chemistry and realized I was like super in love with it as an undergrad. And so that kind of led me into the chemistry space, and going into grad school felt like a really natural next step for me, which I think is a pretty common kind of trajectory for a lot of people. When I got to grad school, I realized that kind of my idea of what it meant to do a PhD and how to really accomplish the goals that I wanted to get out of just being a chemist and like being in love with the chemistry didn't always align with like the program and like kind of milestones and like how you live every day going through a PhD. And that disconnect like hit me really hard, which is kind of why I'm doing what I'm doing now. And we'll probably talk about that later. That kind of led me to where I am today. And so I guess I identify as a chemist, a teacher, an educator, because I got to do all of those things during my PhD. And yeah, now I'm in consulting and I use all of the kind of things that I learned throughout my time as a chemist and an educator, and even my background as a Latina and the experiences I've had to really bring all of that into my work and help communities doing diversity and equity work.
I got to know Chrissy through various like women in engineering groups around campus when we were both graduate students there. And I knew that you were doing a lot of work related to cultural change within your chemistry department. And I know that you, as you alluded to, like you started out as a research chemist and you ended up as like a chemistry education research scholar looking at those like cultural issues. So can you talk a little bit about like what initially, what factors led to you getting started with that work on promoting cultural change and fostering equity in your department? And then if there was any pivot points where you were like, okay, this is actually what I want to do for real. I'm sorry to small molecules, or I don't actually know what you were working on before, where you're like, my heart doesn't sing as much about kinases as it does about toxic mentors.
Yes. So I did look at small molecules. I was looking at hydration spheres and how water molecules interact with each other depending on like the charge of what they're solvating, like super fundamental physical chemistry. And actually my dissertation title is From Water to Human Dynamics, because I ended up, obviously, as you mentioned, I did like study cultural change in communities. And so I love that I get to bring that into the space.
It's awesome that your work from your first lab made it into the final version. I feel like for so many students who change labs, they're kind of forced to abandon whatever it was they worked on in their first lab. So good on you for like making it happen. I know that's not always easy.
Yes. Yeah. And I guess I can talk a little bit about that, but just to go back to your original question. So I did in the chemistry program at Berkeley, your PhD is basically classes and teaching your first year. And then your second year, you take your candidacy exam, which is kind of like the kind of like a master's exam, but basically you pass that and then you get full force approval to like continue your PhD. And so I had passed my candidacy exam studying water. After I passed my candidacy exam, I kind of got to this point where my graduate student mentors that were in the lab, they graduated. And that left me alone with this instrument that was like this giant home built, for lack of a better word, machine, that I just physically, like there were a lot of things that physically as a single person, like whatever could, like I just couldn't handle a lot of things. Like there were pumps that would break and I just Like I needed like 4 or 6 hands to fix them. And so that kind of started this really chain of realizing that my passion for the work that I was doing was being hindered by like physical, mechanical, I guess, barriers. I don't know if that's really the right word. And I got to this point where I felt like I couldn't, like I was being judged by that lack of ability to like fix the instrument rather than like my actual research and like what I could do moving forward as like myself in the lab working on this instrument. And that kind of opened up this whole stream of issues that I was facing that I hadn't realized I was going to face with my mentor. And part of that came from coming into grad school, not really knowing like what it is that I needed to succeed in my PhD. And I think a lot of students kind of face that where they're like, oh, I love the science, so I'm going to do a PhD, and then don't realize that there's a lot of like community work and support that you kind of need to know where you're going to get that from when you choose a lab and choose an advisor and all those things. So that kind of shocked me. And I got to a point where I was like, there's no way I'm going to like get any research done under the circumstances. And like, I was having a lot of conflict with my mentor. And so because of that, I kind of joined the Chemistry Graduate Life Committee, which is what started off my work doing this cultural change. And the CGLC, or the Chemistry Graduate Life Committee, was this like org that had been in the department for a really long time. And they did a lot of, I guess, social event organizing. They helped the administration with like recruitment weekends and getting new grad students oriented and things like that. And so I started asking around if there were other people going through mentorship issues, and it like opened up a can of worms. Everybody was like, of course, like everybody's really unhappy with like mentorship and feeling unsupported and feeling this like imposter feeling and like they're not good enough to be in their group and like all of these things. And I was just like, why is nobody doing anything about this? And there were people in the CGLC that had been working on this for a long time, but I was noticing that there was just this really intense lack of communication between the grad students who were working on those efforts and the faculty. And like that communication barrier was just like so huge that I was like, the approach to this needs to be different, and it needs to be like finding a way to show the faculty that we're really struggling and we need their support and like find a solution together. And so that's kind of what got me into the education space.
You identified this really big problem. What was your next step?
Okay, yeah. So I was like, I had realized that there was this lack of communication and almost also transparency issue, because there was just a lot of like, why is mentorship not a priority for our faculty? Like, why do they not care about us? And like all those things were things that had just never been talked about. So we didn't actually know if those assumptions were true or not, but regardless, the students were feeling really strongly about not feeling like their priorities were heard. And so at this time in the CGLC, I had like was kind of finding out this information about how other students felt really informally. And so I was just having conversations with other students. And like, because of my position in the CGLC, I had this just like really good positionality to like really talk to students and like also have a contact point with the administration. And so I was like, let's do a survey. Let's like try and get some data on what it is that everybody's telling us that we haven't actually quantified yet, so we can show it to the faculty and like have quantitative data on like this general feeling that people are voicing that has to this point only been like anecdotal. And so I went into like, let's do a survey. I had no survey experience. I had no education experience outside of like teaching, like being a TA or a GSI. And so I basically asked everybody that I could find that was willing to help us to like read over the survey, make sure the questions weren't biased, make sure that they made sense, that we were trying to make it as short as possible so that people wouldn't get tired of the survey, but also gather like as much information that would be as helpful as possible. And so it took like a year and a half to get that done. So I started this in probably 2016, and the first survey went out in 2018.
I have to say, you do this work all the time now, so you probably are aware, but I've, even in my grad department and even as an undergrad, I feel like the faculty, they always want data. They're like, well, we're not going to change literally anything unless you survey and tell us the students actually want us to change the tiniest thing ever. And so they're so quick to like send out a Google form that has been read by two people. And the fact that you from the very beginning were like, this is super important. Like, I need people who are experts at sending surveys, which like is a thing you can get your whole PhD in. I think I can tell this is going to be sort of successful. Well, it's clear that you've made a career out of this successfully because even from the very first moment, you were like, we're not going to F around with this survey and make some Google form where I'm like, are you sad in grad school? 1 to 10.
Yeah. Right.
And was there support from the department at this point or for this 18 months that you were making the survey or whatever? Was it just like, okay, Chrissy, come back when it's done?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I guess I want to stop and highlight the fact that it wasn't just me asking external people, like, how do I write the survey? It was like every question that I wrote was based off of like informal conversations, which now I call focus groups or like interviews. Mm-hmm. But these like really targeted discussions about what students are feeling and like how we can kind of get that across in a survey. So like even throughout the whole development of the survey, the community was involved. Like the grad students, postdocs, and the faculty were involved and they were editing every draft. There were people on the CGLC who were just really excited because they were like, we're putting the students' voices into a survey to then like give it back to them to have them give us the data we need to prove to the administration that something's wrong.
Do you have an example of one of those questions in mind?
So there was a couple. So all of this started with mentorship, obviously, because we've been talking about that. And so I guess one of the things that we weren't sure how to phrase was like, should we just assess like how frequently people communicate with their advisors or like how they feel in their group, or like, should we kind of aim to keep this like a direct, do you feel supported? And like, do you feel supported by faculty you interact with and by faculty outside of that sphere? Like, who do you go to for help? And so by conversations with the other grad students and postdocs, it became clear that it was like, do you feel supported was kind of the direction we needed to go in, instead of like, how frequently do you talk to your advisor? Like, because at the end of the day, that doesn't necessarily matter.
An advisor that meets with you every week, that meets with you every week could still make your life like a living hell.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think there's a lot of students where that is the case.
Yeah.
And then also an advisor that meets with you once a year could also make your life like torture.
Yeah, exactly. And those are all really good things to ask when you're picking an advisor. And like, I think retrospectively, by the time I had gone to this point in my PhD, I was like, why did nobody tell me to ask these things? It would have been really helpful. I got really invested in this because there was so much community support for it. And I know you asked about faculty. So at this point, the chair was very aware, like the chair at that time was very aware that we had this problem. Like there was a miscommunication and like lack of trust in the department. And so he was like, go for it. Like, if you feel confident that you could do this, like keep me in the loop, but like you do you. And so that's why I was like, well, cool. The CGLC's got this. And so that's kind of how it started. So 2018 came around and we released the first survey in the spring. I think it was like March, February or March. And we got like 40% response rate from the students. And it was like 75% response rate from the faculty. And I really do attribute that wholeheartedly to like asking people's opinions, like making sure they were involved, making sure that this would be as useful as possible for them. And the survey was one for grad students and postdocs and one for faculty. So it was like measuring both sides of the relationships that we were kind of trying to get insight on. And so at that point, I was like, oh my gosh, this is successful. I'm going to, not that that is what led me to switch groups, but I was like, this is like, I'm actually doing something here. And like, I needed to ask at that point, I was like, there's no way that I'm going to be able to finish my PhD in my current group. And I'm really loving this work. At that point, we had also had a transition in our department chair. And so I asked that new department chair if this was something I could work on and like switch into our chemistry education group. And so I did. That's what I did. Obviously, it was not that easy, but like it didn't actually take that long. I kind of made a plan for like what my PhD would look like. And that's how I got to keep my physical chemistry chapters in there, because I had made a plan of like publishing those chapters by a certain point and then making sure that I had enough chemistry like education work to be able to add to that and have like a whole dissertation at the end. I feel very thankful to that experience, because even though it was really hard while I was going through it, I wouldn't be where I am today without having that whole kind of like awakening of what it is to really have a mentorship relationship that you can thrive with and like really feel supported by.
Yeah. And I think this sets us up to my next question very nicely, which is the listeners are dying to know, like, what was the result of the survey? So when you had these very successful response rates, which I don't know, like in this getting 75% of professors to do literally anything, like click this button or like touch your nose, like that's amazing. So yeah, bring us on the journey. What was the results?
I guess the first thing that happened, so at this point, the other behind the scenes piece that had been going on was, like, I mentioned our, like, the previous department chair was aware of, like, a lot of this kind of, like, mistrust that was happening in the department. And part of that was because we had a couple of town halls before this survey that I did went out. Two in a row, I think, either exactly a year apart or, like, a semester apart. And it was just the students, I think, felt even more frustrated because they were held in that traditional, like, kind of faculty only are talking, and like it wasn't very long, and so there was no space for students to like all get a chance to kind of talk and communicate those points. And I think it's just the way that tradition is, right? Like that's what we think of when we think of a town hall. It's like very power dynamic heavy and like very almost unstructured to a fault. And so that was one of the things that I was very cognizant of coming into this new space I was in, where I was like, we have all this data, we don't want another survey that like just sits in the air and like collects data and nobody does anything with it. Like the whole point we did this effort was to make sure that students' voices could be heard. And so coming in with that and the fact that all these other town halls had been really unsuccessful, I talked to the incoming chair at the time and I was like, can you basically help me find a way to change the tone of this space? Like, we're going to create a different, basically upend the traditional format. So we didn't even use the word town hall. We called it a brainstorming session, or CDIBS, which is a chemistry information and brainstorming session, because acronyms are the best. We invited all the faculty. We were like, hey, we have all this data. Thank you so much for your work and like your input and just being a part of this. And like, we're inviting you to now come and talk about the results with us. Other than that, other than attendance, faculty were not in charge of anything, chair included. Like, we were just like, be present, engage, that's all. And then on the grad student side, I sent an email to the whole department and I was like, hey, we're thinking of flipping the power dynamic basically and having grad students be in charge of this brainstorming session. Can we have like a couple people volunteer to be discussion facilitators? Which basically just meant we're going to give you some of the data, we're going to give you some prompts to lead a discussion, and then we just want you to take notes on what comes out of the group discussion. Yeah, and so we got all these people in a room. The colleague that I was working on this with at the time and I presented like 10 minutes of the data, which was key results of how all the faculty and students felt, some of the things that we aligned all of our values on, and then some of the things that were like, some perception gaps that we were facing, mostly among mentorship and like work-life balance and things like that. And I think starting from a point of everybody agreed on a lot of the like need for diversity questions and need for support for everyone and like feeling we're a community more than like these opposing ends of some dynamic really helped to ground a conversation and like knowing that we all want the same thing, like how can we work to get there? And so I think that was one of the biggest things that made an impact. And then the other thing that made an impact was that I framed all of the discussion points for that session to be around like action items. I was like, let's talk about this. Here's the data. I want you to talk about specific things that we can do that won't take a ton of money or like a whole nother staff or like what is it that we can do like in the moment to like start changing things. And then at the end, everybody voiced what they talked about and the chair didn't respond. He was just like, cool, thank you. I'm making a list. I'm acknowledging your points. And then that was it. I think it felt really empowering for the students to be heard and like have their voices acknowledged. And also having faculty in the room in their small groups to be like, this is how, for example, the current faculty hiring process works. And then for the students, it was like, oh, I didn't know that. So it was like, okay, it works this way. Like, what are some small changes we can make to like start asking about mentorship when we interview candidates? What can we do to make the process a little bit more inclusive? So it helped with transparency and like kind of empowering the students to feel like they were there to be in charge.
That's super interesting. And I'm sure there was a lot that came out of the data. Were there any examples of surprises that came out of the data, either for the grad students or for the faculty, like things they didn't know about how the students were feeling, or both, that come to mind?
So a lot of our like inclusion questions on the survey ended up being like, do you feel like, how important do you think it is that we have a more diverse faculty, for example? And everybody almost unanimously said that they strongly agree with that. And then we also had a question about, and we phrased it very specifically, of like, how do you think that marginalized groups in the department feel about the department? So it wasn't like, how do you feel about the department? It was like, yeah, how do you feel people feel included, basically, that are traditionally excluded? And it was very surprising to see that the faculty and the students aligned on that, of being like, they probably feel not great in our department. And like, I mean, just anecdotally, we have 400, well, at the time we had roughly 400 students in the department. And I was like one of three or four Latinas that I knew of. I think people knew that it was a problem. And I think it was really disheartening for a lot of students to feel like nobody cared about that, when in reality, it's faculty were very aware of it too. And so it really just took having the data and like a conversation about what's going on in recruiting, what's going on when we not just recruit students, but like when they get accepted and come to visit, like what is that experience like for them? And why is it that so many marginalized students are leaving or deciding not to come to Berkeley? That was like one of the biggest things that was, I wouldn't say it was shocking, but it was really cool to see people aligning on that value and being like, let's work toward a solution rather than it being so antagonistic, you know? I really attribute that to opening up new avenues for like clarifying transparency and the way that the department bureaucracy kind of worked.
The discussion on transparency is really interesting because, you know, you're going through grad school and you, in some ways, you're trying to train for, especially if you're planning to stay in academia, like you're training for this kind of position, but you actually don't get a lot of windows into how it works. And you, not only for a training perspective, but as you were saying, that knowledge is really empowering for how you handle a problem, or even how you understand how a problem came to be.
Yeah, absolutely.
What's an example of an action item that came out of it?
Actually, I was going to say this, and your question aligns perfectly with the thought I was having while you were talking. And one of the biggest things that we changed in the first year was updating our graduate student handbook, which I think had existed, but nobody had the link, or like it wasn't distributed widely and it was not updated. And so there was like a lot of things that we were like, we have this, we could just add to it and it wouldn't take that many hours to like split the work. And one of the things that was missing was a section on like, what happens if you don't pass your candidacy exam and what happens if you want to switch groups? And when I switch groups, like I think I mentioned earlier that it wasn't that hard, but it actually like just finding the information and finding who to talk to and like thinking about my options. And I had fellowships. So I was like, if I'm paying for my program, or well, if the foundations that are funding me are paying for my program, like what is the situation? Like, do I have to report my changing a group? All of those questions were really hard for me to figure out. And I think part of the stigma that kind of unconsciously existed about switching groups was like, well, there's no information on it. It's a taboo thing to do. And if you don't have information about how you could make something happen, it's going to feel like a stigma.
I think that's very true in so many departments. And I have friends who either did switch labs or considered switching labs or thought about switching labs, but then just left grad school altogether. Mm-hmm. And for almost every single one, when they finally met with like the chair or the grad division head or whoever this person is that you're supposed to talk to, that person was always like, oh yeah, like you should switch a lab instead of dropping out or instead of being miserable. And often it was like, oh, another person from the Sally lab coming to switch lab. And it's like, in my mind, what really, we can get into this in a little bit, because you are now a consultant and you see the dark side of this in academia. But like, what really gets me, what really like, is people where they have like the same number of students dropping out of their group as they have graduating.
Mm-hmm.
Like in my husband's group in he was in two groups, but in one of his groups, during the 5.5-ish years he was there, 6 students graduated and 6 either dropped out or switched groups.
Oh my gosh.
So it's like, where is the department chair to be like, WTF this lab? Like, this is unacceptable, you know? And like, one student leaves, that's fine, like personal circumstances. But when it starts to have numbers,
yeah,
it's not on the students at that point.
Yeah, absolutely. And that brings up such a good point about like tracking this and like the importance of data in that situation and like the accountability for that. And yeah, which I guess is another rabbit hole we can go down. But I guess from this perspective, like one of the first things we did was add like that section in the grad student handbook that was like, hey, first of all, we don't give you that much time to choose a group when you join, because I think our program still has maybe like 6 weeks from when you start to join your group. We can't change the program that much, but we can make it more normal to say, hey, I'm not vibing with my advisor. Before I get 3 years in, let me switch groups. Even just having that as an option makes the weight of a decision like so much less intense, especially because you are spending 5 years with this person. It's just like any other relationship. If you don't get along, it's going to be miserable. It's, yeah, and people don't talk about that enough. And then we also added like a, what happens if you don't pass your qual, like I said. So like, what are the protocols? Like, do you have to master out? Can you switch groups? Like, what are the kind of options? So that was something that came up. It was one of the first things we did because it felt like easier relative to other things to fix.
It's a low-hanging fruit, basically.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So one thing that is super cool, because you are able to do your advocacy work in the department as part of a chemistry education group, as part of your chemistry PhD, you have publications about this very work. So do you have any like publication that you want to highlight, or any like key research finding, or anything that you did that was kind of unique in the literature around this sort of work?
Yes. And we can link all the publications. They're all open access, so anybody can access them. We can link them all below or in the
Yes, we will do that.
Cool. yeah, so I have 4 publications from this work. The first one, which is in the Journal of Chemical Education, came out in 2019, basically outlining the survey and like how we reformatted the town hall to kind of initiate all of these conversations. And then the second one was actually like, once I switched into chemistry education, I started taking some like qualitative and quantitative methods courses. And part of that was to do a project to kind of develop another survey and like go through the process of systematically doing a survey, which ended up overlapping with a lot of what I did earlier. I just hadn't formally defined it as that, which was awesome. And so I ended up like doing a sense of belonging study with those courses, which I also published, and then also used that data as part of our like survey efforts and leading, and then discuss those data in the town hall. The third paper is like a longitudinal analysis over 3 years of our climate survey data, because we ended up doing the climate survey every spring. And so that one, I think, is probably the one I would direct everyone to read, because it shows positive changes in things like students feeling included, students feeling like they can talk more openly about emotional wellness and like physical wellness with their advisors, people noticing that there were new efforts happening around equity and inclusion, and people knowing who to talk to when they had concerns about wellness or the climate or things like that. And those were all things that nobody had really agreed to when we did the survey the first year. So like watching that change over time was probably the coolest thing, like getting to the end of my PhD and being like, I have actual data that like shows a community changing. That was really, really cool.
And how much more validating than like, look at this water, it's now negative. I mean, obviously, like, there's people that are really into that, but yeah. I can tell, like, watching you talk about this, like, you're lighting up and your heart is full of joy. And so I'm so happy that you were able to make this move, because it's, like, brought you to where you are. And now you're graduating, you have all these killer publications showing that you, Chrissy, can do these things and then lead to cultural change in organizations, which is like extremely hard.
Yeah.
So when did, to me, it's obvious that you would start a business and run with it, but what was that like moment or spark for you? And then also, how do you even do that?
I still struggle with what I'm doing every day and how I do things. So it would have been nice to take some business classes probably, but I think that's just what it comes with the territory. Backtracking a little bit, one of the things that really got me to realize that I could do this in other communities was the last publication that I did was kind of an editorial, like commentary on how the movement started, like how we got buy-in from everybody in the department, and like basically what people at different levels of the department thought about the work and like the movement and how they had viewed it themselves. And I remember like trying to collect people's quotes for the editorial and just going through the process of like, how are we going to tell this story? Because I wanted it to be a little bit emotional, because I think that was part of why this all worked, and like having vulnerable spaces for people to learn from each other and like hear each other's experiences. And I remember having this like realization when that paper came out back 3 years or 4 years earlier, when I published the first paper, like everybody in the department had to read it. It was like had to be approved by everyone. We were all really worried that it was like an exposed dirty laundry or whatever in the department. And then by the time the last one came out, which was like this, we were like telling the story, we were like showing, like sharing the journey with everyone. It just happened. Like everybody was like, yes, this is part of your PhD, do it. Like, I'm so excited for you. And I was like, how cool is it that not only are we showing the data, but we're like in the process of publishing it. Everybody just like is okay with us being vulnerable out in the world as like a top chemistry department. Yeah, we still have a long way to go, but the whole reason this worked is because we were vulnerable, and like having that come up in the publications and experiences, I think paving the way that we kind of need people to go in. And that was like the moment that I feel like I should do this with other communities, because like this is so empowering for me and for everybody to know that like DEI doesn't have to be this big scary thing on the side. Like we can all do our part by just basically opening our hearts to communication and like learning from other people and like being very vulnerable. And so then I was like, well, I don't know, starting a company is really hard. Like, why would I do that? It seems like a whole other thing that I'm not ready for. And I graduated during COVID. My job prospects that I had, I was trying to actually get a postdoc to kind of keep going a little bit deeper into the education space. But a lot of the money for that, I don't know, dried up for, yeah, COVID. And so I got a job as staff at the university, but I also got a client at the same time, like right after I graduated. And I was like, I can't work with you because I have this full-time job unless I start my side hustle, which is what it was at the time. So that's how I actually started my company, because I was like, COVID's happening, everybody's freaking out, I'm freaking out. Bare minimum is to like have my LLC on the side and like work with one client and see how it goes. And so I was working on that 1 hour before I had to go to work, and then probably like 1 or 2 hours every afternoon, and I guess doing the side hustle that I think a lot of Bay Area techies are very familiar with. And then, yeah, I had my job at the university for like a year and a half. And then I just decided that I wasn't happy not being able to work with communities in the same way that I had during my PhD. And I was just really struggling with like going to work every day and not feeling like I had, I don't even know if it was motivation, but it was kind of just like, I reached a point where I was like, I'm not making a difference in this job. And like, I really want to be doing what I did during my PhD elsewhere. So yeah. So since July of this year, 2022, I've been full-time reflecting equity, and it's been really awesome. Also very hard. I've had a lot of meltdowns, but I've gotten over them and I'm here. So it's very exciting.
Tell us a little bit about what reflecting equity does, how you find clients, who are your clients, and then what you do with them to get what they need.
So we are an equity, inclusion, and belonging consulting company. I intentionally leave out the diversity piece of the EIB because I wholeheartedly believe that we can't improve diversity unless the spaces that we are in and like the communities we build are inclusive to welcome people from marginalized identities. and focusing on the sense of belonging piece that people experience in a community. My biggest, I don't really want to call it a pitch, but like the biggest thing that I focus on is changing the narrative of how DEIB initiative decisions get made. I think especially in STEM, they're often done top down. And based on all of my graduate work and the literature that came before me, having top down decisions that don't take into account the input of the people that those decisions will affect leads to terrible outcomes. It's like why a lot of diversity initiatives fail. It's because they don't ask the community what they need. And so I'm trying to like really, with the communities that I work with, make sure that whether it's employees or students or anybody else in the space, make sure that their input is being heard when decisions are made to open the doors for communication and prioritize transparency and like break down those power dynamics. Yeah, so that's kind of what we do. And right now I've been working with academic departments, some fellowship communities, and actually some startups, which is very cool. So I'm staying in the STEM space. Otherwise, the communities I've worked with are pretty, like I would say less than 1,000 people. And I actually love being in the startup space because the level of change or the pace of change is so much faster because they kind of get to experience like setting the tone for a community and for culture and like growing with that. And so that's really cool.
What is the time scale of your relationships with organizations? Like with the chemistry thing, it was obviously like a longitudinal process, but even like the first survey took a whole year and then, you know, it was very building and building. But if I'm like a department chair and I'm like, hi, it's me, the chair of insert toxic department here. My department is a hot mess. I mean, I could like name a department that I know is toxic and then bleep it for comedic effect. But anyway, so like I hire you, I say my department having these problems, like we love what you do. Like, what is the time length of that relationship? Like, how do you approach a client? I mean, you don't have to tell us all your secrets, obviously. Is it the same process of like focus groups lead to surveys, lead to town halls kind of, or brainstorming sessions?
Yes, actually, that's the pitch that I give all of my potential clients. I guess gauging where they're starting from. So often communities do have a lot of survey data. And so there are some clients that I've had where I'm like, okay, let me see what you have and like kind of go from there. Regardless though, I would say the community conversations piece of data they do or don't have is like critical. And so my engagements with clients are typically, I guess I'm aiming for, and like, you know, it's only been a few months, but I have had my one long-term client for over a year. And I, with them, I went through the whole process of writing a survey, doing community conversations, kind of starting to do strategic planning after that into like what would be the most helpful next steps, who's going to do what, and how can we distribute the work so that it doesn't just fall on one person. And it's been incredibly validating to have that one client who I love dearly and like will forever hold close to my heart, because it showed me that I could do this with a different community and like be successful at it. And so that even just walking into going full-time with that information was incredibly validating. So now most of my contracts are, I would say, at least 6 months. And I've been doing it hourly so far, which I think is a traditional first-time consultant situation. But I think the more experience I get, the more I'll be like, this will take me 3 months, or this other piece will take me 4 months.
Or you could be like, after 24 hours or after one day, I can already tell that you guys are going to need the premiere package because it's a disaster up in here.
Everything I do is just learning, you know? So it's like, I probably will get to that point. Maybe, I don't know. Who knows?
From a business perspective, how did you decide how to charge people?
It was a lot of just talking to people and asking friends if they knew of somebody that is doing consulting and like figuring out who charges what, how rates change if you have a PhD versus a master's. And like, especially in the diversity space, traditionally the people that do this work tend to be underpaid and undervalued. I think it's a really good question to ask, just because the biggest hurdle I faced starting my company was like getting over the imposter feels of, I went from being a grad student where my work was basically free to now charging people for my work. And I was so uncomfortable about it for a long time. And I was just like, like, this is just so hard to like wrap my brain around how much I can charge people and internalizing my worth. I would say a lot of it was that interpersonal struggle. But now that I'm here, it's still just like continuous as I grow. Basically, the inflation of experience. I don't know if that makes sense. But like continuing to talk to people about how they navigate that. I found some amazing connections just because of asking those questions of like, how do I even gauge how much I should charge and stuff like that. So I'm really grateful to the people that have supported me in this, because otherwise I really wouldn't know.
It's going to be a new year. You should raise your rates.
Fair enough.
Kayla and I have done one sponsored episode and we gave the client a quote and they said yes right away. And we were like, we should have asked for more.
Fair. Yeah, you never know. And because I was in this crisis of like, I think I'm charging too much money. This is probably like a year ago. Somebody was like, well, you never know, because the worst they can say is no. And then you just decrease it. And I was like, ah, that's really scary. So, you know, you never, I don't know. You never know.
For all the department chairs listening, because we know there are some that listen now that Kayla's old PI is a department chair. What price can you put on your grad students' happiness? You know that 10% of faculty are responsible for 90% of graduate student misery, which that's just a guess, but it's, you know, probably true. And like, what are you going to do about it?
And I will say, by the time I graduated, so yeah, COVID year. Well, I don't know. Now there's three COVID years, but 2020. So in 2020, we had our town hall virtually and I graduated in the fall. So by the time like that fall semester started, one of the interventions we had done was we got a grant to pay students who are invested in DEI to like give them a stipend, give them education support. So they were working with my OPI and then have like a support community, like a little cohort of people that are working on those efforts. So it's possible, just for all the department chairs out there, to like give those students a stipend. And I saw a preprint the other day of an outcome of one of those student groups that got a stipend. And it just makes my heart glow. Yeah, it's still happening. People are working on stuff and they don't even know who I am anymore, which is good.
That's so amazing. That must feel so good.
Yeah, it really does. It's so empowering for the students, I think, and for me to just watch them take ownership of that.
And like when they know your work, but don't even know it was you or like have never met you. Very cool.
So one last question on the business side. How do you recruit a client? Is there a lineup of departments that are like, we have a problem, can you help us? Or are you going up to departments and saying, I think you might need me? How does this work?
Actually, so far it's been word of mouth primarily, and I feel really privileged to have that network. And I think a lot of it is because I did publish like all of my work. I have found a couple clients on LinkedIn. So all the things you hear about LinkedIn being really good for networking, I guess, are true. I haven't ever walked up to somebody point blank and just being like, you need to hire me. I think I've convinced folks that were leaning towards working with me that they needed to work with me, but I haven't done like a cold call yet. And I feel very lucky to do that. So maybe get back to me in a year.
My thought is like the opposite. I think there's listeners out here who are in graduate school or who are in postdocs or who are even faculty who are like, if only my chair would hire Chrissy, then my life would be so much easier. Then my students would be so much happier. Then I personally would be less tormented. So they just fill out the interest form on your website and be like, I'm a nobody second year, but please email my department chair and tell him to hire me. I don't know. You should have a link on your website that's like, refer a department.
That's such a good idea. I'm going to write that down. I know like multiple people at Berkeley have joked that I'm just going to be like every department at Berkeley's on-call consultant, which, you know, do it. I'm happy with that.
So I'm sure there's other people who are listening who are like thinking of starting their own consultancy business based off of their thesis research or something that they're expert in. Any advice or like big lessons learned or mistakes you won't make again? That you wish you had known when you started on your journey?
So I know I mentioned the meltdowns earlier, and I would say the day that I like incorporated, or like, I guess, filed my LLC papers, which really is not a big deal. It's like you fill out maybe five lines of text and submit it. But I had built it up in my head so much. I was like, I can't do this. Like, this is ridiculous. I was like gaslighting myself. And then I just did it. I was like, it literally took 5 seconds. Like, I don't know why I was building that up in my head. And I remember since then thinking about how all the things that I didn't know I was going to get to do in grad school, I just did. I was like, who knows how this will go, but like, I'm just going to do it anyway. And I feel like a lot of grad students have that mentality because we are researching things that haven't been researched before. I feel like taking that mentality into a business, into a workplace is probably the best approach. I think for me, it was like, I've never taken a business class. I don't know what I'm doing. Basically just making it too big in my head. But business is not as big and scary as I think we kind of tend to make, at least I kind of tend to make it. So taking the like grad student mentality, I'll just do it.
Good for you. That's really good advice.
I will say there are so many people out that to help you, I guess, because there's like retrospectively, I didn't know about them. But there's like a whole bunch of national nonprofits that are totally free for businesses, like the small business. Oh my gosh, I always forget the acronym, but the SBDC. And then the SCORE, I think, is another one. And like they all give you like basically free business consulting. And there's webinars and like it's amazing. Like I've even got connected to a lawyer through that network, helped me like answer simple questions, and they don't give me legal advice because technically I'm not hiring them, but just like to navigate some spaces that are really challenging to figure out on your own.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Chrissy, what are your goals for reflecting equity? Like what is the dream?
Okay. I love working in a team. Like I love managing a team. I love being part of a team, and like the ultimate goal just to be like to have a team of really awesome consultants that all kind of just embody this community-based, evidence-based practice and like can bring that into spaces and like foster vulnerable conversations and just change the world and like conquer the world based on like how we approach conversations. That would be amazing. I don't know how that will go. Right now it's just me. I have a team, I have interns, and then I would love to have all of the communities reflect on power, what power means, and like why there's so many dynamics, I guess, based on unequal sharing of power and like what that means, and just have that be like a reflection that all of our clients have at the forefront.
On a similar note, is there any culture or equity tips that you've seen come up time and time again that you just want organizations or individuals that might be listening to this to be aware of?
Yeah, I would say the power is one of them. Like I just said, there's this concept that if you empower students or employees, that will take away from leadership. And I don't know. I don't think power is this thing that can be like in one extreme or another. The more that you kind of share that power, the more power in general that community will have and like bring forward into their work, into their output, into everything they do, and shifting that narrative and being cognizant of like how much more success you can have by like bringing everybody in your community into the conversation. And then along those lines, I would say communication is like one of the biggest, or lack of communication is one of the biggest like barriers to doing equity work. Because I think if people don't know where they stand, or like if there's no open communication and transparency about the way that things work, there's no way that people will feel like they're an important part of the process.
Yeah, it makes sense. How are you going to drive in a fog?
Yeah.
You got to know what's going on.
Oh my gosh, that's such a good analogy.
This is, I think, so valuable. I'm really excited to read some of your publications.
I agree. And I think that a lot of our listeners are going to either want to hire you or like want to hire you, wish that their department would hire you, or be like, if only Chrissy had come to my department before I did, so that I could have had a totally transformed graduate experience. On the one hand, like every academic department like has a lot of work to do, even ones that have made transformative change or small changes. It's just an inherently like disequal system with a lot of inequities just from the get-go, how it was designed in academia. In your experience with your clients, like what is it that makes them realize things have to change, or our department is worse than other departments, or that makes that step of doing something about it in an evidence-based way, like by hiring you or by like whatever other evidence-based thing they would try?
I don't know if I have an answer necessarily, but I will say that one of the biggest distinctions for me, and I've learned this, I guess, since graduating, probably in the staff job that I had, but I don't think it's worth my time or my client's money to hire me if they're not going to be open to like the way that I do the work. I think part of that comes from there's communities that like recognize that they have an issue and really want to solve it but don't know how. And then there's other communities where from the beginning it's clear that like I would just be fighting, and a lot of my hours and my clients' money would be basically paying for me to fight an uphill battle. I personally don't want to do that. So I tend to go for clients that have an open mind and are really willing to engage with me and like make it a collaboration. And that's one of the biggest lessons I've learned since being in my staff job, is like there's a lot of communities out there that really do care. And like, just from what I learned in my grad program, is everybody cared, but there was no communication about it. And so like just even being in a space that came out of my work was really cool and empowering. And like, I think given everything that's happened during COVID, I think there are more communities that would hire me that are willing to be upfront about that, of like, I really just don't know what to do and like, I need your help, as opposed to the other type of client that's like, please just fix us.
It's going to be expensive if you just keep arguing with me.
And emotionally burdensome for me, right? And like, I just don't, like, that's not where I'm at.
I think I could spend a whole podcast just asking you more about what you found with the first surveys.
All of it is in my, well, not all of it, but like the highlights are in my papers. I would recommend starting with the editorial.
We'll link all those, starting with the editorials. I think it's time to move into our favorite segment.
Oh, shameless plug time?
Shameless plug time.
Oh my goodness. What's shameless plug time, Kayla?
Shameless plug time is when you, Chrissy, get to plug whatever you want. Some of our favorite plugs for surf instructors, lipstick types, TV shows, businesses, your own work, whatever you want.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'll just shamelessly plug my company. We're Reflecting Equity, and our web address or website is www.reflectingequity.com, and then all the socials. So we are Reflect Equity on Twitter, just because the reflecting didn't fit in the handle. But then we're at Reflecting Equity on Instagram, and LinkedIn is also Reflecting Equity. So please follow us. We're building up our socials now and very excited to just have had this space to talk about our company and like the values we hold. And yeah, thank you all.
I just followed you while you were talking. I just followed you.
Yes.
Well, I already followed you on Twitter, but yeah, we will link the publications in the show notes. I mean, the intent of this was for us to like learn what you do, but I hope that the result is that a bunch of people hire you, or at least have deep introspection about the true state of their community.
And to know that there's practical steps.
Evidence-based.
With data. Who can argue with data?
And baby steps, because honestly, the most impactful change happens incrementally over time.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for sharing your time with us and with our listeners.
Yeah, thank you.
You can follow Double Shelix on Twitter at Double Shelix Pod. If you have any feedback on this episode or any episode, or just feedback in general, Double Shelix Podcast at Gmail. Also doubleshelix.com. We'd love to hear from you. Oh, and also review us on iTunes. Our number of reviews has been stagnant for like 2 years now, people. So if like 3 more people could review us, we could have an increase of reviews of 10%. And on Spotify, like, do you put a number of stars? I don't even know if you can review podcasts on Spotify. Anyway, tell a friend or a faculty member. If you're not sure how to tell your department chair that they should hire Chrissy or someone like her, just send this link to them in an email. Or yeah, or just email Chrissy directly.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess I'll add that to the shameless plugs. info@reflectingequity.com.
Perfect.
This was so great, Chrissy. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, listeners, and we'll talk to you soon.